Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh,
one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends.
You got a laptop.
Ooh, you got a laptop. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends.
You got a laptop.
There it is.
You got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
So I always say, don't learn about electrical safety by accident. That's a good deal right there. You know, safety first. I posted a video link in the Super Chat room and the People for People chat room of a little animated video about, basically I just typed in what not to do, but the actual video is electrical safety animation. And I'm sitting here watching these these cartoon characters, animated characters in there doing some pretty wild stuff, some of which I probably in the past have done, and you might have done as well, you know, like knowing where your electrical cord is when you're using a saw would probably be a good idea, because I actually did cut through an electrical cord one time while cutting a board. Probably not the best thing to do, that's I'm sure of. There's all different types of the safety tips out there, but don't learn electrical safety by accident, folks. It's just not the way you want to find out about what not to do as far as electricity goes. You know, when you look back at the history of the battery, it's pretty interesting. I'm going to play a couple things about the history of the battery, and I work my way back to electrical safety. You know, if you go out there and you get on YouTube and you look up compilations of vape batteries blowing up in people's pockets, man, it appears to be funny, but it's actually not, because that's those lithium-ion batteries, when they go up in smoke, they just they have some capability of doing some serious damage. But it also kind of plays into some of the things I've been talking about, different ways to use electricity. If you go look out there into cold electricity, it's something completely different. It's still electricity nonetheless. And the way that we use electricity being done properly. I mean, I guess, like I tried to say to people, if your appliances are getting hot, you're pushing too much power to it. Electricity is an amazing thing, but it has to be respected. Otherwise, you know, you can cause some serious harm, you know, not excluding death or, you know, fires and such like that. But sometimes the ignorance of what is possible gets people to do some crazy things. Like, there's a lot of things that you can buy on the market that will turn one single outlet into probably anywhere from 4 to 10 outlets. And unless it's in one of those power strips that has a surge protector and a built-in breaker system, that is not advisable. And depending on what you're actually running on it, even those ones with the power strip are not advisable. A lot of folks don't understand electricity and the dangers of, you know, high current and stuff like that. And so it's something that you really should seriously look into before doing things. A lot of these people that have all these different extension cords strung in all different directions of the house, and, you know, in my younger day, prior to really paying attention to electrical safety, I probably was guilty of some of the things. But once I got to realizing the dangers and the hazards and started using precautions and understanding, you know, about the differences in types of circuit breakers and fuses, and knowing what you've got in your home is a really plus when it comes to keeping you safe. And not buying cheap knockoff products is probably one of the better things to do. I mean, you're going to save some money, I'm sure, but you don't want something that's going to blow up in your pocket or set fire to your house. And so I'm really careful about what I plug in, when I plug it in, and whether or not it needs to be monitored or not. You know, especially when it comes to different types of space heaters out there. There's a lot of different space heaters you know, really pay attention to, because of the way that they're designed and how much power that they pull. You know, some of them have some really serious built-in engineer flaws. And I want to keep everybody safe. You know, can't do that, obviously. Can't be everywhere at one time to say, hey, you know, that's probably not a good idea. But each and every one of you should take a little bit of time to look into some electrical safety and you know, learn the do's and don'ts around electricity, at least up until the point when we finally get to the deal where we start using electricity in a more nature-friendly manner, to where it's not nearly as dangerous. You know, electricity, you got to have some respect for it, because if you don't, you know, a couple little mistakes could you know, really cause you some serious problems. You know, a lot of people are into this vaping stuff, and they will take this machine that they buy to you know, basically vape and smoke or whatever, and they'll modify it. And by doing that, they run the risk, because some of these batteries, even though lithium-ion batteries are fairly good technology, you know, they'll hold a lot of power. Well, in the industry out there, there are those who will take shortcuts when they make these batteries and not necessarily have safety as a number one priority. So, yeah, you be real cautious and know what you're doing before you mess with things like that, because if you go out there and look at those videos of different people who've had them things explode in their face or in their hands, you know, it's not something you want to go through, I'll tell you that. And, you know, when it comes down to other technologies, safer technologies, even when you go back to old lead-acid batteries, there were warning labels on there about hydrogen buildup in these batteries, and you didn't want to, you know, connect them backwards or arc across them, because you could actually, you know, cause an explosion on that battery. So common sense dictates, when you're around electricity, number one, proceed cautiously, slowly, and precisely. Every time you do anything, know exactly what you're doing before you do it, because it only takes a split second before things go seriously awry. And so, you know, the best thing that I can tell you is, individually, you really seriously need to take a look at it. You know, go out and take a, you know, maybe a fire safety class or electrical safety class. It even if you're not going to be an electrical engineer, or you just going to call the electrician whenever something goes wrong, you know, you're the front line of defense when it comes to taking care of your family. So you want to make sure that you keep yourself safe and them safe at the same time. And by overloading circuits, if your breaker for some reason decides not to function properly and it doesn't trip at the right time, well, that extra energy coming down that line has the capability of causing your wiring to reach its thermal breakdown and start a fire. And you don't want that. Trust me, that's not a good thing. But there's a lot of unfortunate incidents that have occurred, and even in countries that you know, a lot of poverty is responsible for people not being able to have electricity. They have people that will go out and, you know, throw wires over top of power lines and, you know, basically get you some bootleg electricity into your house and stuff like that. And my research, I hope to one day solve that issue to where people don't have to worry about, you know, stealing electricity or whatever. You know, the power companies, you know, whatever you think about it, you know, if somebody is put in a position to where they actually have to steal electricity in order to get, you know, get some sort of comforts, some sort of, you know, something to cook on, or heat, or lighting in their home, that's a shame, because we got the technology today to literally put electricity in everybody's house so that everybody can enjoy the luxuries of, you know, lighting and heating and air conditioning and stuff like that. But we live in a strange world where greed kind of rules everything. But in the process, some people take shortcuts and try to either save themselves some money, or try to, you know, basically get something the hard way, and a lot of times it ends really poorly, you know, not excluding death, which is sad. I don't want anybody to die. But, you know, even in the industry, the people that take the chances and they take shortcuts when they make things like lithium ion batteries, or, you know, not taking proper precautions with these batteries, read the warning labels on everything, folks. And they're there for a reason, mostly to say that, yeah, we warned you ahead of time, and you it was operator error, you did it, you got hurt, you started the fire, whatever, and so it makes it harder for you to be able to you know, claim any kind of compensation for when somebody took a shortcut and it actually cost you a lot of problems. There's a lot of recalls on a lot of products out there that probably need to be paid attention to as well. It's all about safety. You want to stay safe, and you know, electricity, energy is a wonderful thing. It's a force of nature that both is highly revered, but needs to be highly respected and needs to be, you know, understood. Now, with our best understandings, we pretty much created some really awesome things. We got TVs and computers and phones and wireless products such as drills and saws and all that kind of stuff. But every one of those comes with precautions that you need to understand about different types of batteries and stuff. You know, with that said, I'm gonna go back a little bit, and I'm gonna go into a couple little podcasts that talk about history of batteries, so you get just a general idea. Most of you probably already know the majority of this. It don't hurt to every once in a while peek back in time and listen to some of the things. This first one actually kind of talks about the batteries exploding. Should you be afraid of lithium-ion batteries? It's good technology. But even with older technology, you still have to be aware that electricity can be dangerous. You know, used properly, it's like magic as far as I'm concerned. But let's go into this one right here real quick.
Surveillance footage captured the moment Josh Hamilton's pants suddenly burst into flames at a Kentucky gas station.
So first it was the hoverboard fires, vaping explosions, and now most recently the Samsung Note 7 fires that have been caused by lithium-ion batteries. So what do all these battery fires have in common? Let's start with the hoverboard. Now if we just look up hoverboards on Google, the first products we find make the price of a hoverboard somewhere between $200 to $300. On average, a single hoverboard has a lithium-ion battery pack with roughly 18 to 20 lithium-ion cells. So at the basic price, with one lithium-ion cell costing $7 on average, a battery of this size costs between $126 to $140. Now, if you're a Chinese manufacturer mass-producing these hoverboards, then already most of your profit is going towards the battery. This is where Chinese hoverboard manufacturers take shortcuts to reduce costs. Buying genuine lithium-ion batteries in bulk can save some money. What's even cheaper for these manufacturers to do is just buy counterfeit lithium-ion batteries from battery pack manufacturers and thereby save price. This creates two problems with the battery system. For one, these counterfeit batteries are designed with cost in mind, and most safety factors, such as the charge-discharge rate, are disregarded, making these batteries extremely dangerous and prone to overheating. Secondly, the batteries are often improperly wired together with cheap charging connectors, as you see here. Counterfeit batteries such as these are often branded with Samsung or Panasonic logos to deceive the buyers and make them think that these batteries are safe. In fact, one of the more memorable occurrences is when one of these hoverboard batteries literally was filled with sand. Here's a good example of improper wiring. Notice how the circuit board is wedged in between the batteries. If a wire happens to come loose, it could short-circuit the circuit board and damage the batteries, which in turn could cause them to over-discharge because now the circuit board that was once protecting them is no longer in use. Incidentally, this same issue happened to one of my lithium-ion battery packs most recently because I forgot to protect the circuit board. Luckily, we were able to remove the short circuit before the batteries caught fire. Now here's what a proper wiring job looks like. Notice how the circuit board isn't facing the terminal, and the terminals are covered with a protective mesh. This battery pack is much less likely to burst into flames. And there's been a similar issue with e-cigarettes exploding in people's faces. Once again, a lot of counterfeit batteries are used for vaping because and many of these manufacturers falsely advertise that these batteries have an incredibly high battery capacity. Here's a classical example of a battery that allegedly has a 6,000 milliamp capacity. Keep in mind that the highest achieved capacity to date is roughly 3,500 milliamps. Better yet, Here's another counterfeit battery with a 9,500 milliamp capacity. So, most people buying these batteries think, hey, I'm going to buy a battery that's going to get me 5 hours of vaping. Yeah, right. It's not going to happen. The capacity on these batteries is usually much less than advertised. A 5,000 milliamp battery is probably somewhere between 800 and 900 milliamps, and it's not going to get you much time of use. Additionally, since many of these e-cigarettes consume so much power, the high discharge often causes these counterfeit batteries to explode, and they're not even meant for high discharge purposes in the first place. So, many of these lithium-ion battery fires that we see, which are more than often caused by counterfeit batteries, lead many people to believe that the cylindrical lithium-ion battery cells are dangerous. This gives a false notion that many of the products that use lithium-ion batteries, such as Teslas or RC vehicles, are more dangerous. But as long as you get your batteries from reliable sources like Panasonic, the chance of a battery fire is much less likely. Panasonic batteries have higher capacity and better discharge properties than the standard counterfeit versions. Additionally, they're pretty durable. The cells used in Tesla batteries are even more resilient. Here's a video where a Tesla cell is drained down to 0 volts. Now normally, draining a battery to 0 volts is quite dangerous, but since the Tesla cells are so well designed, the cell can be discharged to 0 volts and recharged without overheating issues or significant battery damage. Even in the case of a short circuit, genuine lithium-ion batteries have several protective measures to prevent them from catching on fire. Now take a look at this lithium-ion that was just shorted out. In the unlikely case that a battery short-circuits, the terminals heat up and the electrolyte fluid begins to boil. The vent holes in top of the terminal allow the battery to depressurize the electrolyte steam, thereby reducing the battery capacity and making a pressure explosion much less likely. In the end, you're more likely to see a small fire shoot out of the battery rather than a large explosion. While this still can cause damage, it's a much better option than having a battery explode, which results in a shrapnel cloud. But in counterfeit batteries, this vent hole safety feature is often ineffective. Here's an internal view of the battery. Notice how the crimped can holds the entire junction in place. If this crimped can is too tight, it can cause the battery to build up pressure without releasing pressure from the vent holes. It's also important to notice that the two terminals, represented in red and gray, are separated by a very thin gasket. Now, if this gasket isn't installed with the right precision, then at some point in the future, the two terminals will probably touch, thus causing the battery to short circuit. The central problem with all these issues and product recalls is not the lithium-ion batteries themselves, but rather the improper design protocol that goes into each product. In the end, the notorious lithium-ion battery that most of us have heard of are not as dangerous as they're made out to be, as long as you know how to use it and where to get it from. Thanks for watching the video. I hope you guys enjoyed. Be sure to like and subscribe, and I'll see you later.
So, you know, you really got to know about battery technology whenever you start using it, because taking shortcuts is a bad idea. Well, Stephen Gibbons over there in the Super Chat room put up a picture of a sign, and it's pretty funny. I think I might need to get me a sign like this to put on the door of my lab. It says, "Warning, no stupid people beyond this point." Oh, man, that's something else. Yeah, I'm gonna have to get me a copy of that and put it out there. I need to type a message in. Let me go ahead while I'm typing this message in. Let me go ahead and start playing this this second one here. Alrighty, here we go. Just a little bit of history of the battery.
When I say power, you probably think of a power outlet. But the fact is, batteries were used long before electrical grids or generators were in use. The term battery was first used in 1749 by Benjamin Franklin to describe a set of capacitors he'd wired in series in order to produce a higher voltage. He was using the word in the sense of a set of units connected together in series. But it eventually caught on so well that Nowadays, we use the term battery to describe even a single power cell. Of course, Franklin's capacitors are not batteries in the modern sense. We define a battery as a container consisting of one or more cells in which chemical energy is converted into electricity and used as a source of power. It would be another 11 years before someone used a chemical reaction to reliably produce electricity. In 1800, Alessandro Volta stacked copper and zinc discs on top of one another, separated by pieces of cloth soaked in salt water. He called this a voltaic pile, and it was the first source of relatively reliable continuous electricity in convenient pile form. And this is considered the first definitive battery. The zinc discs served as anodes, copper as cathodes, and the salt water was an electrolyte. With these simple materials, we can easily create our own voltaic pile. Let's start by making a single voltaic cell in a beaker. The beaker cell produces 0.796 volts. Now I'll build a bunch of cells together as a voltaic pile, using these cardboard squares, which have already been soaked in the salt water. It's not sturdy by any means, but this leaning tower of Volta produces enough power to light a 5mm blue LED. And for the record, that is 9 cells in the pile, producing 6.33 volts. Not long after the voltaic pile was created, William Cruikshank came along and improved the design by laying it on its side in a slotted box. This helped prevent the electrolyte from leaking and causing shorts between the plates, and it was known, appropriately enough, as a trough of the battery. But moving away from piles and troughs, in 1836, John Frederick Daniell pushed the battery further with his Daniell cell. The Daniell cell's defining feature was its use of a porous barrier between two different electrolyte solutions. In this example, we see the copper cathode sitting inside of a porous earthenware pot filled with copper sulfate. This pot is then submerged inside of a container filled with zinc sulfate and encircled by the zinc anode. The porous earthenware allows ions to pass between the electrolytes, but hydrogen bubbles are prevented from forming. This greatly increased the cell's lifespan when compared to a voltaic pile. The Daniell cell wasn't perfect, but its improved reliability made it suitable for widespread use. In fact, the standard for 1 volt is based on the output of 1 Daniell cell. All of the batteries we've talked about up until now would be considered primary, which means once their chemical reactions are depleted, that's it, they need to be replaced. Now, a secondary battery can be recharged multiple times and used again without being replaced, which is a good thing. In 1859, French physicist Gaston Plante created the first rechargeable battery using a lead anode and a lead dioxide cathode immersed in sulfuric acid. The chemical reactions inside Plante's lead acid cell could be reversed by passing a reverse current through it. A pretty amazing feature, but its weight and size made it impractical for most uses. Still, it was suitable for some things. In fact, lead-acid cells are still used in cars today. So far, all of these early batteries have used liquid electrolytes, which pose pretty obvious challenges to portability. But in 1886, Carl Gassner created the first dry cell battery using an electrolyte paste composed of ammonium chloride and plaster of Paris. Because it didn't spill and could be used in any orientation, the zinc-carbon cell opened the gates to many new portable uses, such as flashlights. The zinc-carbon cell would eventually be refined by the National Carbon Company and evolve into our modern alkaline battery. You can easily see how little the design has changed over the years, just a bit of help from a hacksaw. It's densely packed, but all the elements are still here. A carbon cathode down the center, a thin shell of zinc serving as the anode, and a thick, pasty black electrolyte. Of course, more and more nowadays, when we think batteries, we think lithium. In fact, you probably carry around a lithium battery every day in your pocket. Because of its low density and high electrical potential, lithium has long been considered an ideal material for use in batteries. But it wasn't till the 1970s that the first primary lithium cells were made widely available. Further developments from researchers around the globe led to the release of the lithium-ion battery in 1991, and later the lithium polymer battery in 1997. The major difference between lithium-ion and lithium-polymer is in the electrolyte. A microporous electrolyte used in lithium-polymer batteries means they can deliver the same power as lithium-ions, but in a lighter, flexible package. Otherwise, chemistries are the same. Inside of a lithium-ion cell, you'll find layers of anode, usually composed of carbon, cathode, of metal oxide, and an electrolyte containing a lithium salt. So ultimately, batteries come down to chemistry. And although you'll hear about revolutionary changes being made to battery design, the basics remain the same. Anode, cathode, and electrolyte. If anything major changes, I'll let you know.
So anyway, that's just a little basic rundown of some batteries, a little bit of history of batteries and stuff like that. It's so ridiculously simple to make a basic battery, a piece of zinc, a piece of copper, and some salt water, and you can get some voltage created and stuff like that. And so it's like really simple, but I honestly believe that once you understand how energy moves around, how energy travels, that it's possible to build a battery that doesn't use or rely on dangerous chemistry that could, create a problem. When you talk about capacitor technology, there are dangers to capacitors that you need to be aware of. When you short these capacitors out, they instantly discharge that's an amazing amount of power. And they can be literally lethal if, depending on, size and how much power is actually in that capacitor. So when you're messing around with capacitors, you really got to be aware of what the potential of these things are. But the further we get through time and to the future, to where we start using the energy the proper way, we'll be able to make make use of electricity in such an incredibly safe manner that you very rarely, if ever, hear in anything about some negative effects of what happened, explosions or somebody getting electrocuted. Or just go out and look at some of them YouTube videos, folks, of people with some of these modified vapes in their pocket with the cheap batteries, and it's a pretty messy deal. Even with the lead acid batteries, you still have to have some common sense when you're messing around with these things. You got to have safety precautions. Don't learn electrical safety by accident. It's want to keep everybody safe. And so when it comes down, when I finally get my new lab together, which I'm frustrated because it's taken so long. It's just a financial issue on my part. I'll get it resolved. But once I get everything together, I'm going to start showing people some different ways to use things that you probably hadn't thought of unless you've been listening to Mad Science for a long time. I've been talking about all this kind of stuff. And why it is that our devices are getting too much power, why they're getting hot, why they end up finally reaching a thermal breakdown and things fail. You know, transistors get too hot, resistors get too hot, they end up burning up, and you know, some of the fumes that come off of those things, it's not something you want to be breathing in. But if done properly, using electricity properly, you would ensure that nothing ever reaches its thermal breakdown point. So after the point of manufacturing, once you got this in your possession and you're running this differently, you know, using electricity safer than ever before and more efficiently, then you should never have an incident where your transistors or any of your computer processors get too hot and then they end up failing because of that reason. You know, proper maintenance on your computer would make a big difference as far as how long that thing will last. You know, all the dust that gets built up in the back and clogs up the fan, and it starts a domino effect that starts breaking down your system. So every once in a while, when you get a chance, take some air and blow it in there and clean that thing up. You know, take the time to open it up and make sure it's not plugged in. When you do it, just open it up, clean it out real good, get all the dust off of the little heat sinks and the vents and all that kind of stuff. That way, you know, they won't be getting hot and you'll be able to keep your computer running a lot longer. But always practice electrical safety when messing with anything. And if you're not sure how to do it, don't do it. Get somebody else who's certified to do it. You know, don't let somebody who just thinks that, yeah, I could do it. And if they're not so bright, don't take the chance. I know that sounds harsh, but you don't want, like that sign says, warning, no stupid people passed here. When it comes to electrical safety, you take all the precautions. So I want to go to this next one right here. This talks about some history of electricity as well. And sometimes you got to go backward in order to move forward. So let's go with this right here.
There are many situations where we are dependent on stored electrical energy. We could hardly imagine living anymore without batteries and a constant source of electricity. Whether in our cell phones, our laptops, or in electrically powered bicycles, batteries are increasingly a feature of everyday life. Electrically powered vehicles are increasingly important in urban transport, and they need high-performance batteries. We can trace the development of batteries back to a man who was the first to find a source of energy that produced a constant electric current, and so ushered in the age of electricity. Alessandro Volta was born into an aristocratic family in the Italian town of Como on the 18th of February 1745. Even as a schoolboy, he showed a great interest in science, in particular electricity. At this time, while the phenomenon of electricity as such was familiar, not much was known about its origins. Itinerant showmen would demonstrate the strange effects of electric current to crowds that looked on in amazement. Mysterious crackles, bright sparks, and, the climax of the performance, a dagger point that could ignite alcohol. In 1769, still only a 24-year-old student, Alessandro Volta published a scientific article with the Latin title De Via Attractiva Ignis Electrici, on the attractive force of electric fire. 6 years later, he was appointed to teach physics in his hometown of Como, but to start with, he also concerned himself with chemistry. In the early years of his time in Como, he developed the electrophorus, a device that generated electricity by friction. An electrophorus consists of two parts, a metal stamp with an insulated handle and a cake of resin. When the resin is rubbed with cat's fur, electricity is produced by friction. This electricity is transferred to the metal stamp, which discharges in a moment. By rubbing it with the cat's fur, excess negative charges are created in the resin cake. If the electrically neutral metal stamp is held close to the plate, the positive charges in the stamp are attracted by the negative ones in the cake. They collect on the side of the stamp facing the cake. The negative charges in the stamp are, by contrast, repelled and collect on the upper side. If this side is grounded, the negative charges are drained away. This means that the metal stamp is now deficient in negative charges. If it is removed from the cake, it is positively charged. If, however, a grounded rod is brought close to the plate, there is a flow of electric current. A spark flies, restoring the balance of charges. This disparity in charge is known as a potential difference, and the more the cake and the metal stamp are separated, the higher it is. The easiest way to imagine potential difference is by analogy with a water pipe. Here, the potential difference corresponds to the pressure of the water in the pipe. The pressure may be high even if no water is flowing. This is the case when the tap is turned off. The same is true of potential difference. It may be high even if there is no electricity flowing, no current, in other words. With his electrophorus, Volta succeeded in producing an inexpensive device that could generate high potential differences. His research led to his appointment at the age of 35 as professor of physics at the University of Pavia. But Alessandro Volta wasn't the only one to be taking an interest in electricity. In 1789, the professor of anatomy in Bologna, Luigi Galvani, started experiments with frogs' legs. He made a surprising observation. If he touched the nerve fibers of amputated legs with two different metals, the muscles would suddenly twitch. Galvani was convinced he had proved the existence of animal electricity. When Volta heard about Galvani's results, he was fascinated. At once he set out repeating the experiments. However, he did not believe in Galvani's explanation. By performing his own experiments, he discovered that the reason for the electric current lay not in the muscles and nerves of the prepared frog's leg, but in the two different metals. The fluids in the tissues of the frog merely acted as a conductor. Volta showed that as long as you have a conductive liquid such as brine, all you needed was two different metals in order to demonstrate an electric effect. This is known as the voltaic effect. He started experimenting with various metals and looking into their properties. His measuring instrument was his own tongue. If you touch it with two different metals at the same time, an electric current will flow. It makes itself felt as a tingly, sour taste. Painstakingly, Volta tested every possible combination of metals. He entered them in a table. The order corresponded to the strength of the electric reaction. However, he didn't only investigate metals like zinc, tin, lead, iron, copper, platinum, gold, silver, and mercury, which he called conductors of the first class. He also discovered that liquids and bodily fluids were conductors too. These he called conductors of the second class. His results meant that his long-lasting dispute with Galvani was finally settled in his favor, and the upshot was an invention that made him world famous. For in his experiments, he had realized that the electrical effect could be substantially increased by introducing an acid between the different metals. He constructed a device which made him famous, the voltaic pile. Volta constructed a column consisting of copper coins alternating with plates of zinc. The metals were separated by leather discs soaked in brine. When he connected the two ends of the voltaic pile with a wire and his hand, electric current flowed. Volta had invented the first battery. But how does it work? What's going on inside the voltaic pile? A battery converts chemical energy into electrical energy. There are two chambers separated by a porous membrane. In one chamber is a zinc electrode, in the other a copper electrode. The function of a battery is based on the different chemical reactions of the metals. The zinc electrode gives off positive ions to the solution. The resulting deficiency means it is now negatively charged. Something similar happens in the copper cell, but on a much smaller scale. This is because copper has a much smaller tendency to give off positive ions than zinc. We say that it is less oxidative. This also means that the negative charge is much less than on the zinc electrode. If the electrodes are now connected by a metal wire, the surplus negative charges, or electrons, now flow along the wire, from the zinc electrode to the copper electrode. This does not last long, though, because sooner or later the chemical processes in the battery stop. Even so, the voltaic pile was the first device which created an electric current for any length of time. It was a crucial step in the further investigation of electricity. After almost 10 years of tireless research, Alessandro Volta finally reached his goal. At the age of 55, he announced his new invention in a letter to the Royal Society in London. The renowned British Scientific Academy honoured Volta with its highest award, the Copley Medal, in the days before Nobel Prizes, probably the pinnacle of scientific achievement. The following year, 1810, Volta went to Paris, where he demonstrated his voltaic pile to the French Academy of Sciences in the presence of Napoleon. The emperor was much taken by the invention. He granted Volta an annuity, naming him a count and a senator of Italy, which was then under French occupation. In 1815, Volta became director of the philosophical faculty in Pavia. 4 years later, he retired to Como, where he died on the 5th of March, 1827, at the age of 82. More than 50 years later, from August to November 1881, the Palais de l'Industrie in Paris played host to the first International Electrical Congress. Numerous technical innovations were presented, such as Siemens' electric tram and Edison's electric lighting system using incandescent bulbs. But the main purpose of the participants was to standardize electrical units. Volta was honored by having a physical unit named after him. the International Electrical Congress chose the name volt for the unit of electric potential difference, or electromotive force, and it is still valid today. Count Alessandro Volta was seen in the 19th century as the founder of a new age, the age of electricity. Today, there are all sorts of different batteries, but one thing has not changed since Volta's day. Sooner or later, they're exhausted. They run flat, and no more current is produced. They then have to be exchanged. As in Volta's day, most batteries use two different metals, but these metals and the acids that batteries also contain are not environmentally friendly, especially when the batteries are not properly disposed of. That's why the search is on for new combinations. Investigations are going on into high-performance batteries that use natural organic compounds, which are biodegradable after use. For years, science and industry have been working on the development of new batteries with a higher energy density and which are absolutely leak-proof. In place of metal containers, plastic foil coated in aluminium or some other metal is being tried. This allows the battery to have any shape you want. Very useful when you have to integrate the battery into a designer product, like a mobile phone or laptop. But performance has not been forgotten either. Large batteries, for bicycles for example, are also being developed. A mobile electricity supply has a high priority in our modern society. Although the development of batteries is proceeding apace, the principle is the same as it was in the original voltaic pile.
So that gives you a little bit of interesting history about the battery. You know, it's amazing when you think about where we've actually came from to where we actually are now as far as our use of electricity. But we still got a lot of improvement to do. You heard about, they're talking about how, you know, we got to get a better mobile, way to use electricity to, basically cut down, number one, on environmental waste as far as these batteries or how long they'll last. You know, rechargeable batteries are good, but there's technology already available, such as capacitor technology, that incorporated with these other battery technologies would make it so that that battery could actually last a lot longer. And so, you know, when it all comes down to it, it's about getting the right people together. That's why I always keep on talking about the dream team, you know, bringing the brilliant minds from all around the world to come together to troubleshoot stuff. We know how to make a basic battery all the way up to, you know, the more higher tech batteries, you know, smaller yet more powerful batteries than ever before. And there are also, batteries that can, you know, automatically change the electrolyte to fresh electrolyte. You know, one of the problems when the battery is together, you know, like the, just say, just a simple battery like the salt water and, a copper plate and a zinc plate or whatever, two different types of metals. Well, eventually that chemical reaction balances everything out and it comes to a stop. And so, you know, you got to refresh that. When you do that, then, you know, the chemical reaction will restart again. But with the understanding of magnetism and some of the solid state equipment that we've got these days, you're going to see a day when, you know, using something as simple as thermoelectrics could make the battery at some point in time become nearly obsolete. You know, I'm sure that there's always going to be a need for energy storage, but we had the technology and the capability right now to do it in such an incredible fashion and as fast as necessary. That's what I hope to show when I get my lab together, is what I've been doing with these capacitors, that there are absolutely no batteries in the entire system. And because I understand how this energy is actually moving from point A to point B, and using this electricity in a completely different manner, almost to the extent of cold electricity. Were cold electricity something different? Go look up the definition of cold electricity and look into it, and you might be surprised, you know, the difference in that and the standard form that we're actually using now. You know, it's safer, and it's when you get a lot of current, it's the amperage that gets you. You know, when you got all this current, your body can withstand, you know, voltage. Pretty high voltage as far as that goes. Tesla used to be in, in with his Tesla coils, and he'd be into thousands, if not millions of volts, and for some reason it just doesn't seem to harm him, you know, and so there was something else to learn there about electricity and how it actually travels, you know, electricity either, you know, traveling through the wire or on the outer skin of that wire, whatever, you know, allowing that current to flow. The only thing that copper wire is essentially railroad tracks, you know. It guides that energy where you want it to go. And when we loop it around, all those electron flow producing the magnetic field causes the next one in line to add to the next one and makes a stronger magnetic field for the more turns. And the thickness of the wire could determine the amount of current, and the thinness of the wire could determine how many volts you have in there. It's basically no different than the water coming through your garden hose. When you put your thumb over that water, you restrict that flow, and that little bitty area where all that pressure, the potential pressure is behind your thumb, and it has a really small path coming out, it increases that pressure, and where you can now squirt that water clear across the yard, as opposed to, you know, the volume of water that comes out, you know, right there at the end of that hose naturally. So I think something like 60 psi is the average amount of water that comes out of a garden hose, depending on where you're at, I guess. But 60 psi, and then you push your thumb over there to hold that 60 psi back, and the little pinhole that you leave open is enough to squirt that water magnitudes times farther than it would have normally. And so, you know, there's, if you can understand water pressure, air pressure, then you can understand electrical pressure as well. And so that gets into the safety thing. What, you know, what's going on? How much power is actually behind that amount, you know, in that outlet or whatever that's coming through that coming down the line to you? And when it comes to battery technology, you can't discount some of these new batteries. You got to be real careful with. They got a lot of power. You don't want to stick your tongue on some of these new batteries, I guarantee you that. You know, 9-volt battery's got enough power in it to literally cause you some serious issues. But people stick their tongue on them all the time. But, you know, far as I'm concerned, you get lucky every time you do that if you don't get some kind of adverse effect from it. But either way, understanding, battery technology and how far we've actually come, and then the modern day, there's a lot of power stored in them modern day batteries, and that means that with that lot of power, you got to be careful, because the chemical reaction that basically runs away, a runaway effect of that chemical reaction, is now basically the equivalent of discharging a fully charged 800 microfarad capacitor all in one shot. You'll actually weld with that. That's a lot of power instantaneously released. And so by using power differently and allowing the excess energy to go somewhere else, then you're reducing the effect that occurs, the heating and all that, that causes the thermal breakdown and causes your parts to fail or whatever. So I want to play this next one right here. It's a little short one, I think. 5 lithium battery safety tips.
Lithium batteries have made headlines often in recent years, and when they do, it's usually bad news. Stories of batteries igniting, smoking, or exploding may scare you, and let's face it, they should. In this video, we'll share some simple tips for safely handling, storing, and charging your lithium battery-powered devices to prevent an incident like the ones you may have seen on the news. Let's get right to it. Here's the first tip. Do not let a loose battery come in contact with metal objects like coins, keys, or jewelry. Metal conducts electricity, and this could cause an issue if your battery's circuitry is damaged. Next, keep your battery-powered devices out of extreme heat. Don't leave your smartphone near the stove, the radiator, or in a hot car. Extreme heat can cause the battery to overheat or short-circuit, leading to a fire. Now, we've all dropped our cell phone at one time or another. Be aware that dropping your device on a hard surface can damage the battery, making it susceptible to problems. If you believe your device is damaged, or if your device gets wet, bring it to a professional to be inspected or replaced. When you charge your device, be aware that using an incompatible charger or cable can cause issues. So when it's time to charge up, use only chargers and charging cables that are approved or compatible with your device. Incompatible third-party or second-hand chargers can overheat your charging cable or your device's battery, causing a fire risk. If you're not sure whether your charger or cable is compatible with your device, check the owner's manual or contact the manufacturer. The same goes for devices and batteries themselves. While a low, low price for a cheap knockoff product may be tempting, these kinds of devices may contain untested or poorly manufactured batteries, which could cost you more in the long run. Finally, remember, if your device gets wet, it may still operate normally, but that doesn't mean there's not a problem. The circuitry in the battery may still corrode over time and someday pose a fire or shock hazard. Now, while we can't predict every contingency or prepare for every accident, following these safety tips will go a long way towards keeping your lithium battery-powered devices safe and working properly for a long time. But we're not done yet. In our next video, we'll give you some tips for flying with lithium batteries. If you travel for business, you won't want to miss this one. Thank you for watching. If you learned something from this video, please like and share it below. And subscribe to our YouTube channel for more like this.
So, you know, it's pretty ironic and probably a good thing to take note of that there are some places that won't allow you to ship batteries through the mail or, you know, even on airplanes and stuff like that because of the dangers of them actually either overheating or shorting out and that kind of stuff. Well, that's why I want to get into the differences of how to use electricity so that you don't even have to have that chemistry in order to be able to, produce an electrical current. And these modern-day capacitors are getting really, really incredible. They act more like batteries than you would think. And so, in a circuit where you absolutely have no batteries, and you have a charging system using modern technology, once you understand how a magnetic field is actually produced, it is ridiculously simple and doesn't take near the amount of power to run these motors that we're actually using to run these motors. And a lot of these circuits using pulse DC that mimics AC current, and that DC has a really powerful punch, and so it has a real strong magnetic field, and we can generate these using solid state equipment. So we're not talking about spinning magnets past anything anymore. We're talking about taking a small amount of voltage from basically old style technology like a battery or even thermoelectrics, and using transistors to take that and pulse that power into a coil system that produces that magnetic field. So we're actually getting into the space age portion of what I'm talking about. You could see a day where the body temperature, your body's 98.6 degrees, and you would have sensors that would actually use the temperature and the chemistry in your fingers in order to generate a voltage that then in turn could be ramped up to charge up devices and stuff, and even wireless charging technologies that we have available these days. It's pretty exciting. It's getting more and more closer to what I'm talking about. And I'm positive that at some point, they're actually going to put this information on the table. Same information I've been talking about for years. The hard part about anything is it always costs money to do things. You know, to get out there, to do the research, to buy the materials necessary. And, you know, so corporations have the edge when it comes to technology. And they also have the responsibility, since they have the edge when it comes to technology, to do everything that they can to make sure that safety is first. So that you don't have a ticking time bomb in your pocket, you know, like a lithium-ion battery that overheats and, you know, has a chemical runaway. And, you know, so with that said, if you can find a way in order to do what the battery does without chemistry, then that is the way to go. You know, you got a lot of different types of batteries out there. Alkaline batteries, nickel metal hydride batteries, lithium ion batteries, nickel cadmium batteries, lead acid batteries. There's all different types of batteries out there, mostly that rely on chemistry. But once you understand how that energy travels, we have options available to where we can take the chemistry portion out of it to some extent. I mean, you're still going to need, you know, two different types of metals from our understanding of how this actually works, and some sort of safe fashion in order to be able to, you know, store that energy. And like I said, with the modern day capacitor technology, you've got regular capacitors, you know, AC capacitors, DC capacitors, all of them have their different uses. All of them have their different capabilities, all the way up to like the Maxwell boost caps that basically have the power to store energy like a battery and use that energy just like a battery. People have been replacing lead acid batteries in their vehicles with capacitor banks, which at number one is a smaller, lighter weight deal. So as opposed to a 20-pound battery, you got a 2-pound capacitor bank that does the same job. And once you understand how to charge and discharge these things safely, it becomes you know, a no-brainer from that point on. You can move energy around rapidly if you understand how it actually moves around. You don't need near the amount of power, and you don't need near the amount of current. Without that massive amount of current, that reduces you know, the resistance, and the resistance is what actually causes the heat and causes things to get hot and then fail. So if you can move this energy around, you know, just understanding the voltage pressure, and you can move it around rapidly, you can store it and pressurize it. And as long as you have an understanding that once that capacitor is fully charged, it's not something you want to put your fingers on, because that's a lot of stored power in a little tiny compact space, and it can literally hurt you. Seriously. It's a lot of voltage pressure stored up. But, you know, if all the safety precautions are taken, the worst thing that could possibly happen to this deal is not that it catches fire, just that it overpressurizes and it destroys the capacitor. You know, there's a dielectric in between the two plates inside there. And if you go up and look at, there's a scale that will tell you the different dielectrics. The best dielectric out there would be glass, because what it means is that it has the highest breakdown point where, you know, before those plates can actually short through that dielectric, then that means that it has to be at a certain amount of voltage. So when you look at these capacitors, you'll see their maximum rating on the side of the capacitor may be 300 volts. You take it over 300 volts, and it can literally basically send that energy from plate to plate right through the dielectric, making that capacitor no longer good anymore. You just basically open the gate, shorted it out permanently. But when you have that type of understanding now we have the capability to use materials out there that we can make capacitors that will hold thousands, if not millions, of volts. That's a lot of power. You know, you could build a capacitor bank that would be massive, or you could quite literally store the equivalence of a lightning bolt inside that. Now, obviously, that's not something you want to discharge firsthand. There would have to be some serious safety precautions involved in that. But if you get the understanding of how this energy actually wants to, you know, nature wants to balance those plates out. It wants to put it back to where they were before, and it will do it. It will take the shortest path it can. And if a capacitor is, let's say, maximum 300 volts, you got those terminals on the top of that capacitor that are far enough apart that it would take, 1,000 volts or more, maybe, to leap across from one terminal to the next, so you can hold that energy in there for long periods of time. But if you overcharged it, then that the energy between those two poles, to those two terminals, could literally ionize the air in between the two terminals and give it a path. It just no different than putting a screwdriver across these two terminals and allowing that instant discharge to occur. So they've taken that into consideration when they design capacitors. As long as you understand about overcharging them and that kind of stuff there, then you don't have any issues. But the chemistry involved in it isn't the chemical chemistry like you would have with a battery, where you're actually risking a serious fire or something like that, or chemical burns. So there are safety deals, safety pluses with these type of deals if you use them properly. And if you know that if you've got a load already connected to the capacitor before you ever charge it up, then you're not going to harm that device. That's what I've been showing with these systems that I use, where there's absolutely no batteries involved in the entire system. See, if I fully charged a 300 volt capacitor and then tried to hook a 9 volt appliance to it, that instant surge through there would burn that thing right out. But if I have a 300 volt capacitor and it's already connected to that 9 volt, it's already draining power off, but it's doing it in a controlled fashion. It's not instantaneously discharging. So as the voltage is coming in, that capacitor is only giving that device what that device is requiring to run. And this is where a lot of people have missed it when it comes to alternative energy. When it comes down to talking about free energy and making electric generators that are self-looping and stuff like that, they didn't realize that with the batteries that they're trying to use, it takes longer to charge those batteries because of the resistance, because of the way that you have to charge those batteries. You can't charge it fast enough. Well, because capacitors have a charge and discharge rate that are rapidly, you can charge them rapidly, you can discharge them rapidly, or you can even discharge them slowly, or you can charge them slowly. So you can control the amount of power that goes into that capacitor. And if you use that capacitor as a storage bank, you may never ever reach the full potential of the full 300 volts that it's capable of, and you're just constantly putting power to this thing, and so you're able to only give that device the amount of power that it's necessary to run. So in that case, that 300 volt capacitor could safely run a 9 volt device without ever even damaging it. It's just like constantly putting water into the pool, and then you got all these other smaller pools that are connected via a pipe or something, and it's only draining off a little bit, just enough to keep them all topped off. And since water is always going to try to find its level, then pressure pushing down on that, when one of those pools gets empty, it's going to constantly fill itself back up. The same exact concept can be used with capacitor technology. So we have what we need to do it. And as long as we understand the safety concerns and how these things actually work, then you can get into the good stuff. Or, you know, like I said, when you talk about making a self-looping generator, and you don't understand the basic physics of, you know, the lens effect and, you know, cogging and all that kind of stuff, back EMF and eddy currents and all that, where, you know, you're basically looping that power that's going out of the generator you want to draw the power from, and then through your load, and then right back into the same generator you're trying to, you pull power off, and then that thing starts to create a second magnetic field in there that acts as a brake and slows down the armature and makes it so your self-looping system won't work. Now, a lot of folks have got really, really seriously close. They got them to be more efficient. They got them to run longer, but they never was able to be able to start pulling more power off of it than, you know, that thing was capable of. It's because they didn't understand a few things. But if you get the basics about how these batteries work, all the safety concerns, you get to the point where you use this thing properly, you use each device, such as a battery, for one purpose, to just keep a constant flow, and you use the buffer between the battery and the device as the protection for the device that you want to run. So the only thing that battery does is maintain that power from that point on. So you got a buffer between the generator that's outputting the power that gives all that energy a place to flow, because you're not, even if you only got like a 1500 watt generator, you're not going to be able to charge that battery fast enough in order to, you know, replace the power that you're using. But if you're not trying to discharge that battery, all you're doing is you've got the power that you're coming out, and it gives all that extra energy a place to go, because that battery can't accept that energy fast enough. You give that extra energy a place to go, so it's in storage. It's still there. You haven't lost it. And then, so from that point on, that energy will flow across that battery, across the battery terminals, and then it'll go down into the next buffer that would be between your battery and your device that you want to run, so your device isn't trying to receive more power than it actually needs in order to run. When that happens, that energy wants to back up in the system, which produces that problem that we get where we actually get the heat that causes the fire. So by allowing that energy to flow naturally and away from the device, you can use electricity in such a different fashion, such a more incredibly efficient fashion, that you're not overheating the battery. You don't have to wait hours to charge this battery back up, because at that point in the game, that battery is doing nothing else but maintaining the constant flow of energy. So it's there to supplement, and the actual load is being ran off of your buffer, which is the capacitor bank. And so because capacitors are able to charge and discharge completely, rapidly, then that means that capacitor is not going to get hot. It's just there to transfer that energy from whatever you're generating the power from, through the first buffer, down into the battery, across the terminals of the battery, keeping the battery topped off at all times, and then down into the second buffer that is between your load that's already connected to that bank. And so you just allow that energy to flow naturally, and any excess energy will be stored and have a place to go. So you may not need a 300 volt capacitor, but that gives you a large storage space, a lot of surface area, to allow all that electrons to be out there and, you know, never ever be able to reach the point where that capacitor is overcharged and discharges and then blows up. As long as you have it connected to a load, you're giving that energy a place to go. As long as you understand that when that power is coming out of that wall, it ain't stopping. 120 volts AC at 60 hertz is a continuous back and forth to that outlet, and it's looking for a place to go. And if you got a short run to your computer, and you got a transformer inside your computer that's either a step up or a step down transformer, well, that transformer can only use so much power. It can't use more than it's capable of. And so where does that energy go? Science says energy can neither be created nor can it be destroyed. So where does it go? Well, it's what it's doing is it's pressurizing that wire in between the outlet and your appliance, and it's backing up and it's creating resistance where all that current, that excess current, has nowhere to go, and it starts to build thermal energy that begins to heat your wiring up. And once the wiring gets hot and the insulation on the wiring reaches its thermal breakdown, it will fail. And from that point on, you run the risk of a wire fire. So we have breaker systems inside of our houses and fuses that will use that thermal energy. When the fuse gets too hot, there's too much current going through there, it will literally either melt a little piece of the strip of metal in between there that's set for anywhere from 5 amps all the way up to whatever, 30 amps or more, like in your cars and stuff. And so that heat is enough to melt that wire. Too much current going through there generates enough heat to melt that wire and shut the circuit off. In your breaker switches, it's the same thing. And when it gets to a certain temperature, it will literally trip that breaker, cutting the power from your device and from the wall to your outlet or whatever, so that you don't have a wire fire. But if for some reason that thing doesn't function properly, and it doesn't shut it off in time, it could be tragic. So you need to understand that about, you know, when it comes to electrical safety, that, you know, if it says, you know, so many watts or so many amps, you need to understand that that breaker, if you got a 15-amp breaker, you don't want to be running something that is using 30 amps. You know, multiple devices on one outlet. You go out and you look at the differences in some of the different ways that they make the wall outlets that are at your house. Read the specs on them. What's the maximum amperage that these things can withstand before they'll actually start to melt and cause a direct short that could start a wire fire in your house? And so all these folks that go out there and they use these little cables, little extension cords for, you know, trying to run a space heater. You don't want to run a space heater off of a little extension cord. And that ground plug is on there for a reason. And so you want to make sure that if it has a ground plug on there, that it's in an outlet that can receive that ground plug. You know, so that energy don't go to you. It goes back and it causes either the GFI system, ground fault indicator switch to shut itself off for safety reasons, or it causes the breaker or the fuse to kick off. So if you got a spider web of all different types of wires running around your house, you need to get a better plan, because that's not a good thing. It could cause a really serious problem. Don't learn electrical safety by accident. Don't learn fire safety by accident either. You want to keep your family safe, but you got to take the time, even if you don't classify yourself as a rocket scientist or, you know, a genius or whatever, ensure that you check the numbers. If it says 15 amps and you're only going to be using 10 amps, then you're safe. But if it says 15 amps and you're trying to use 20 or 30 amps, you know, that's too much power going to that device, and you know, it will cause it to back up and it will cause it to fail. And luckily, hopefully, the safety portions of the deal will, you know, catch it before it's too late. But better safe than sorry is what I'm always saying. So there's all kinds of things to factor in when it comes to electricity. Electricity is amazing. It's like magic as far as I'm concerned. I love the fact that we can harness nature, and if we start doing it in a completely harmonious fashion with nature, we've already got free electricity. Those folks out there that want to argue till they're blue in the face that there's no such thing as free energy, they haven't obviously paid attention in the school of nature. They haven't paid attention in science class. You know, it's sad that we live in a world where a government indoctrination center such as the public schools and the colleges have got people to the extent where they can't think outside the box. They can't think for themselves. So sure, they can quote the book, They can get good grades by being able to repeat what somebody else said. But if you go back in time and you look at all these different people who were the inventors who discovered, you know, things like electricity and the capabilities of, they weren't indoctrinated into believing, not being able to believe something. They were there for the discovery portion of it. That's where modern science fails. We're not trying to discover, you know, we already put so many limitations on ourselves through the educational system, which is a shame, because you should try to encourage young students to want to ask the tough questions. Okay, you say this is happening because of that, but what's this over here? Why is it this one time doesn't match with what this particular law of physics says? That's common sense. You know, once we get there, you know, I'm looking forward to the day when we start using energy in a completely different fashion than what we do now, because we have the capabilities of really seriously doing some really cool stuff. Really amazing. And, you know, you got all these people that want to be like so-called debunkers of free energy. Oh, you can't get out more than you put in. You don't need to get out more than you put in. The amount of power that you're already generating already surpasses what those devices can actually handle. An electric fan doesn't require near the amount of power that we're pushing to it. In your area, you might be using 50 hertz. Over here, we're using 60 hertz. 120 volts at 60 hertz or 220 at 50 hertz over there. You know, there's a difference in the way that we're using that energy, and I bet if you do the research, you'll find out that the ones that are using it at 50 hertz has probably got appliances that last much longer than the ones at 60 hertz. So, you know, it's all a matter of understanding how that energy travels. And Chris in the chat room over there said, how's the project coming along? Well, it's kind of at a momentary standstill until I get the lab done. I need the room to work. I need a few things to situate it all. I'm getting closer. You know, because of life and it's in your average aggravations, you know, extra expenses that weren't counted on or whatever, weren't expected, that it slowed me down a bit. But when I get this lab together, it's going to be not only a nice-looking lab, it's going to be comfortable to work in, it's going to be organized, and so when I'm showing you this stuff real-time via Twitch or Facebook or YouTube, I want you to be able to not only see it clearly, I want you to be able to understand it, because I may only get one chance to show what I'm trying to share with everybody. And I'm ready to put it down there on the table. You know, this isn't some sort of voodoo version of energy like some of those con artists out there that run around talking about how you gotta love your reactor or you ain't gonna get no free electricity or anything like that. This is taking everything that science and nature has already proven and showing, you know, things that pretty much I feel like got overlooked in the classrooms to show people about how it is that we could be at the very least more energy efficient. They're always talking about, you know, reducing your carbon footprint, which is so dang ridiculous. It's mind blowing. It's stupid. It has no basis in real science. Yet you have that taught in the educational system as if it was true fact. And so I could sit around and argue till I'm blue in the face with people about real science, but, you know, seeing is believing, I guess, so I'm going to have to show them what it is I'm talking about. And that's what I'm working on. So as far as my project, it's coming along fine. It's kind of like I said, it's kind of at a standstill until I get the financial issue worked out where, you know, I can put this thing together the way I visualize it, so that when you're looking through that monitor on your side, you can see what's going on. Where everything's organized, you can see where these wires are going, you can see the mechanical reaction that's going on, and it can, the way that I'm building this thing, you'll be able to see the mechanical portion of it, and it'll be easy for me to explain to you exactly what's happening in this particular device and how this energy is being used completely different. And the way that, this energy is able to do a lot more work than what we're actually doing right now. We waste more energy through heat and losses and friction than you can possibly imagine. If we could just reach that incredible efficiency, you wouldn't have this so-called energy crisis. There isn't no energy crisis. It's just a matter of, you're not using it properly. Now, there's a lot of alternative energy researchers out there that have been saying it for a long time. You're not using this energy properly. It's capable of a whole lot more. And as a matter of fact, the reason why we can talk about a lot of different safety issues is because of the fact that it's not being used properly. You're shoving way too much current to those devices. You don't need that much current to run that electrical fan or that TV set. You don't need that much. Voltage is pressure. Voltage is what actually gets the work done. The current just sends a lot of power to it at one time. You don't need that much power to run that. And there's been tons of experiments out there. They used to tune electric motors with capacitors, and they didn't understand what was actually happening necessarily at the time. But what they were doing was they were reducing how much power was actually going to that motor, because there's too much power going to that motor, which causes it to use more current. And it causes it to get hotter. But by using these capacitors to tune that motor, they seen that they could run these motors on a lot less energy. So it's already proven concept. It's not rocket science. It's not science fiction. It's science fact. Once you understand how this power, this energy is moving around, forget all the high-tech terminology and all the craziness, all the so-called laws of physics that's written in stone. They're helpful. You could use those laws of physics to your advantage when you know this one action is going to cause this reaction. You have to ask yourself, why is this happening? That second magnetic field that's produced inside the generator, there is a way around that. And you take that energy off the generator and you move it down the line completely away from it before you ever even tap it into a load. And now you're talking. See, Chris says, how long will a capacitor run a device? Well, it depends on the amount of power that device actually takes. Something like an LED obviously is not going to require near the amount of power as an incandescent light bulb. So if you got a large capacitor, you can run that for long periods of time. If you go back and you look at some of my videos where I'm talking about how I'm using this DDS signal generator, when I charge this entire system up, I come back the next day and this entire system is still working. There's still portions of the circuit. They'll shut down the ones that require the most amount of power. They'll go down in order all the way down to the least amount of power, all the way down to one single blinking LED. But I've left this system uncharged for several days and I still have energy flowing through that system. It still hasn't had a chance to completely balance itself out to zero again. So with the right size capacitor bank, you can run things for long, long periods of time. And if the design of the capacitors are such as that you've got lots and lots of surface area in that capacitor, you can store more charge on there for longer periods of time. There's different types of capacitors, and each one of them have their own specific purpose. In this particular circuit, some of which I'm using, that you wouldn't do this in a normal circuit, because like the run capacitors that I use, the start capacitors, these start capacitors aren't designed to withstand current for long periods of time. They're just there to give that extra oomph to the motor to get it spinning around. And then at that point, it's actually kicked out of the circuit so that you don't destroy that capacitor. So, with that said, since I'm not using current, I'm using the voltage pressure, I can still use these safely in the circuit without destroying them. They'll never get hot. The way that I'm using this electricity is designed to make sure that that device never gets hot. It will still produce the magnetic field in the transformers. It will still produce the same effect in the secondaries and producing the electricity at whatever voltage I want it to. The key is the transformer itself will never experience the eddy currents or the resistance that causes it to get hot. So I could run these 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and that transformer will never ever be able to reach its thermal breakdown. But it will still produce the electricity at whatever design that I want it. And so by understanding that, the failure is in the thermal breakdown of any given part in the entire system. I got a bridge rectifier, full wave bridge rectifier that is good for 1,000 volts at 100 amps. And I ain't even putting a fraction of any type of amperage into that rectifier. And the voltage is changing from an AC voltage wave to a DC voltage. And so I'm able to rectify that from AC to DC, and in the process of that, never get that thing hot. So that means that bridge rectifier will last indefinitely. It will never, ever be able to reach its thermal breakdown, so it won't be able to fail. This particular rectifier has built-in heat sinks, and it can't get hot. Because I'm not shoving current through there. This thing could handle up to 100 amps of current. But since I'm only using the voltage to change it from an AC wave to a DC, then I'm still able to use that direct current to charge these banks. And by doing this, you'll start to have light bulbs come on in your head about how we actually charge batteries. When we charge batteries, we got charging systems like a 10 amp battery charger. This may be a battery that could have like a couple hundred cold cranking amps to it. But that battery still has resistance. When you're trying to shove 10 amps of power to it, something's got to give in there. And it has to be thermally protected so it'll shut itself off if you overcharge. But either way, it takes a long time to charge that battery at 10 amps because of the way that battery is designed, because of the resistance in there. So the thing has to have built-in safety precautions. Otherwise, you overcharge that battery and either the battery explodes or the doggone charger catches on fire. Because you're trying to shove too much power to that thing. It can't take that power fast enough. Batteries have their place. They're good. They're good at holding a lot of power in a smaller space. But at the same sense, they're not designed to charge and discharge as fast as capacitors are. And so with that said, if you understand about storage space, like a number of batteries. You got one battery. It has, let's say it's got a 100 amp hour battery. All right, so you can run it for an hour for 100. You can run 100 amps for 1 hour. Anything above that 100 amps will decrease that time. The same thing applies with capacitors. How much storage you got in that thing? How much you're going to be draining off of there? But if you're using it in the manner in which I'm talking about, you've got that backup battery. The battery in your circuit is no longer there as the mule, so to speak. It's not the one that's carrying the load. The capacitor is carrying the load, and you're running it straight off that capacitor. And so all that energy coming in, it not only has a place to go and be stored, but it also is basically absorbing that, so that that battery itself isn't being charged and discharged like that. So if you're only taking a little bit off that battery at a time, and it's coming in just as fast as you're taking it off, then that battery will stay topped off. You'll keep it that imbalance of those plates constant, and you'll keep a constant flow of power. So, you know, getting the current back, that's not even a problem. You just have to understand what's going on there. You know, if I took a garden hose and I took that 60 PSI, it might take me longer to squirt it a smaller stream to fill up a large tank. But once I got that large tank filled up, you know, I got my power back again. You know, it works the same with electricity. And so if I need that, if I need more pressure, if I need more current, it's a matter of whether or not I'm going to open this valve wider or shut it down tighter. Either way, close it, you know, it's also ridiculously simple. Anyway, I need to take a breather, so I'm going to play this little safety deal right here and let you think about a few more things when it comes to electricity, because if you think about how much power is actually coming down that line at the high frequencies that they're sending that so they can get it to go out farther, they understand what I'm talking about. They understand how to get that energy to travel down the line. And there's still safety precautions that they need to take as well in order to ensure that when they go out there to work on these things, they don't have a lightning bolt jump from that power line over to the shortest path to ground. So when you pull that bucket truck up there, you just created a spark gap, a path to ground. So they take all that into consideration. They ground that truck, or they make the truck out of something that's less conductive or whatever. There's a lot of stuff to factor in when it comes to the way we get our electricity from the power company. You know, they use that as an excuse to shower us with really high bills in a friendly fashion, right? So when it comes down to somebody like me trying to tell you that we could actually do this ourselves in a much safer and more efficient manner for a lot less, well, that's why you get those turkeys that run out there hauling about, there ain't no such thing as free electricity. Ain't no such thing as free energy. Like I'm not sitting here trying to talk about getting more out than I'm putting in. I'm not talking about over unity or zero point or anything like that. I'm talking about doing what nature has been doing forever and doing it in such properly fashion and perfect harmony with nature that you don't have to pay a doggone electric bill. I mean, the earth is 3/4 covered in water and people are still dying of thirst. How's that happen? It's ridiculous. Somebody didn't pay attention in science class. Let me play this so I can take a little bit of a breather.
This electrical awareness video is focused on identifying hazards around electricity on the job site. All other hazards on the job require the same focus and respect while performing your hazard assessments and should not be disregarded or have any less importance placed on them. Electricity is all around us. It is an essential element in our daily lives. Nearly everything we do is connected with electricity. On the job site, working around electricity can be very safe when workers properly identify and mitigate the hazards. If hazards are ignored, electricity can strike out, and its effects can be devastating. As with any task on the job site, you should never attempt to perform work without the proper training and experience. Only qualified personnel should be involved in the operation or repairs of electrical equipment. Inadequate training, lack of experience, and failure to recognize potential hazards could result in electric shock or arc flash. Electric shock can occur when a worker approaches or contacts exposed, energized electrical equipment. Workers' exposure to electric shock can vary from a tingling sensation to involuntary muscle contraction causing respiratory paralysis, ventricular fibrillation, and severe internal and external burns, and even death. The victim is also at risk of other serious physical harm, such as falling from heights. Arc flash results from two electrical components sustaining an arcing fault. If conditions are correct, an arc flash will result, followed by a blast wave containing molten metal, shrapnel, and toxic gases. No matter the severity, any worker exposed to any level of electrical shock or flash must seek medical attention. While electricity has the power to seriously harm you, the risks of electrical shock can be mitigated, and work can be safely carried out without incident. Electrical safety begins with the proper use of field-level hazard assessments and identifying the potential hazards. Your hazard assessment is the first step in protecting you and everyone else on your job site from any associated hazards, which may include electric shock. A brief inspection of your job site will help identify other potential electrical hazards. While performing your walkthrough, look, listen, and smell. This will assist you in identifying the hazards on your site. All power tools and equipment should be plugged into a GFCI. This is a must when working in wet, moist, or exterior locations. Ground fault circuit interrupters monitor the balance of electricity flow and can detect even minor imbalances and will trip, reducing the risk of electric shock. Bump testing the GFCI before use must be done to ensure the unit is functioning properly. By pressing the test button, the receptacle should trip. Pushing the reset button should restore power to the GFCI unit. If this fails, the GFCI unit is defective and must be taken out of service. Adequate lighting is a must in your work area. If light levels are too low, additional lighting must be installed on either a temporary or permanent basis. Whenever working directly around electrical equipment, the de-energizing of equipment is the recommended practice. De-energizing equipment removes the potential for electrical shock as power is removed. This can be achieved with the proper use of a lockout-tagout system. While basic procedures may vary from site to site, it is essential for you to understand the lockout-tagout procedure being used at your job site. One thing that does not change from site to site, however, is that you may never remove another party's lock in a lockout-tagout system. Before using any electrical cords or tools, always inspect individual items to ensure they're in good working order. Faulty equipment can lead to personal injury and poses a risk to all those on a job site. If items are damaged or are in poor working condition, tag the item and take it out of service for repair or replacement. Always know the locations of fire extinguishers on your site. These should be rated safe for use with electrical fires. Common practice is the use of a dry chemical type ABC fire extinguisher. Depending on the type of work you're doing, a hot work or electrical permit may be required. Always ensure you're in compliance with your site-specific policies and procedures regarding permitting controls. Always consider overhead hazards in your work area. Power lines are an ever-present danger due to the possibility of electrical arcing or direct contact and should always be marked. High voltage hazards can also be in the ground. Line locates are required by law before any ground disturbance takes place. Always call before you dig. Occupational health and safety regulates minimum work distances to electrical sources with certain voltages and should be referred to before working near any high voltage sources. It is extremely important to recognize equipment in an abnormal condition, such as an open electrical panel, exposed wiring, sparks, smoke, or fire. When you encounter this situation, use the look, listen, and smell approach, as this is an immediate cue that extra caution should be used and may indicate a potentially dangerous situation is present. Water or liquids pose additional risk of electrical shock due to high conductivity. The hazard should be removed only after the area is de-energized. If you recognize a hazard that you cannot rectify, ensure that you ask questions and seek solutions from the appropriate personnel on site. Do not take it for granted that other workers understand the scope of your work or that there is a potential danger to you or to them. Common PPE requirements on job sites include cotton or fire-resistant pants, a cotton or fire-resistant shirt with a minimum 6-inch to full-length sleeve, electric shock-resistant or static dissipative footwear, Type 1 and 2 Class E and G protective headwear, additional high-vis clothing, safety glasses, and work blocks. For electrical workers that conduct their tasks around energized equipment, you should be aware of the CSA standard Z462. Competent workers need to be trained to this standard, which will help identify the hazards associated around electrical sources, what controls can be best used, as well as the additional specialized PPE required, such as arc flash clothing, arc flash face shield, rubber insulated gloves which include leather protectors, and more. PPE is your last line of defense. Do not use PPE as a substitute for the opportunity to control or remove existing hazards. In the event that all safeguard systems have failed and a coworker is being shocked, never come in direct contact with the worker, or you may become entrapped in the shock cycle. If possible, deactivate the power source and activate your emergency response plan. Working around electricity can be performed safely and without incident by executing sound judgment and diligent observations in order to create your field-level hazard assessment, and by following the proper safe work procedures. You'll be well on your way to completing your task without incident. Remember the importance of using the proper equipment in good condition and by wearing the proper personal protective equipment. By employing all these safeguards, not only will you help keep yourself and your coworkers safe, you'll help ensure that you'll return safely every day to the people who count on you the most.
Basically, that just gives you a rundown of somebody who actually works around, electricity for a living and stuff like that, and how, industry takes safety really seriously. So you need to do the same. The best rule of thumb out there, the first rule of making sure that you're safe is, when in doubt, don't. Just flat out, do not do it. If you're in doubt, anything around electricity, don't do it. There's been certain times when I'm working on projects that I might overpower and burn up a part that I really wished I hadn't burned up because I put too much power to it, which I knew better, had a slight doubt about it, tried it, and failed. So, it cost me a few pennies to get it resolved, but, that's because you got to remember that one rule. When in doubt, don't. If there's any kind of safety problems, hazards, or whatever, and you're not sure about it, you're not 100% sure about it, if you got even the remote doubt, don't. Don't do it. And if anybody else is around you and they think they know, but they're not exactly sure, if there's any doubt involved in the situation, don't. Just don't do it. That's the easy way to go about it. Now, earlier I posted a link in there of an animation of things not to do. And so I have to scroll up here and see if I can find it again and repost it for those that just joining in. If you're over in the Super Chat room, you should be able to see it down there in the deal. But there's a video and the animation. And go look at that video and it'll give you some good ideas of what not to do. Let me see. I can't even find it now. I'll find it later and repost it. But, it's kind of, it appears to be funny, but it's not. Because a lot of folks make a lot of mistakes that were in this little video. And those little mistakes right there can pretty much cause you some serious problems. It can cause you some serious, issues. You don't want to get yourself hurt. You don't want to get others hurt. And so on down the line. So, it's really not a joke when it comes to electrical safety. So my hope is that by the time I get my new lab together and I start showing people a different way to use energy, at the very least a more efficient and safer way, You won't have to worry about wire fires anymore. You give that energy a place to go. Right now, those pole transformers that we got out there, they're pushing more power to the devices that we got. They don't need that much power. I'm watching this video as I'm talking. I got the volume off of it. The guy is drilling through the wall and hits the power line inside the wall because you didn't know where the wall was. Well, they make these nifty little devices you can actually take around the wireless AC testers, and you can find wiring that's behind the wall. There's actually technology that'll show you what's behind the wall. So, it's no excuse for doing that. You want to be safe. But go watch this animation and you see some of the things that, some people do. Like I said, the animation appears to be funny, but when in reality it comes down to safety. It's not funny whenever you learn about electrical safety the wrong way. This guy can't, he's got a short cord and he's going to try to use a longer cord. And it's not rated for what he's doing. And so, it's going to fail. That's the problem. You gotta really pay attention to all the safety deals. He's trying to run a welder off of a doggone cord that's not designed to carry that much. And you just have to see it to believe it. Now his boss is all sooted up from the deal. Go watch it if you got an opportunity to do so. But either way, safety first, folks. That's the simple of it. When you're doing alternative energy, understand that you have to have respect for, electricity. Because, lack of respect for electricity is really going to cause you some serious problems. Maybe even, all the way not excluding death. And don't want anybody getting hurt. So that's why I always say, don't learn electrical safety by accident. So someday down the line, this will all be a thing of the past, because the technologies that are coming down the line is going to be using energy in a completely different fashion. We got things, plasma technologies that are coming in that are going to be able to produce energy with so much less input than you think. And so all these folks that, pretty much try to poo-poo any idea about free energy or alternative energy, all that kind of stuff, they're going to see you soon enough. It's coming down the road. So I don't really worry about it too much when all I'm trying to say what can't be done. My aim is to prove what can be done, and I'm aiming to show people something that they might have overlooked. And who knows? Maybe one day I'll be in the science book. If I am, I am. If not, whatever. But at least I'm going to try to do the best I can for people to show them, how to not only stay safe, but how to be more efficient. And, the ultimate goal is to show the power company, put the power company in its place. Now they have the capability to just shut you off if you don't pay your bill. And if it's wintertime or summertime, both of them come with their negative aspects. Summertime, you obviously need your refrigerator to keep your food cool. In the wintertime, maybe you could stick your refrigerator out there on the porch and let nature keep it cool. But, it's another thing about how we actually engineer our homes that we live in. If we had a understanding of what nature's already provided, we could build systems, we could engineer systems that would direct the cold air outside into the refrigerator to get it so that the doggone compressor never has to kick on, which means it wouldn't use any electricity in the wintertime. And you could, believe it or not, you could even set it up so that it would be thermally reactive, so that whenever it got a certain temperature, it would open the door and swap where that heat is guided to. Either the heat off of the compressor being guided into the room to help you out, where, like, for example, in the summertime, you're running your air conditioning in the same room that you're running your refrigerator. And so your air conditioner has to compensate for that lost energy that the heat that's coming off of your refrigerator. And so it's not efficient that way. But if you had a way to guide that out outside to vent that outside, that excess heat outside, then you wouldn't have that extra energy that's fighting against the energy that you're trying to keep yourself cool. So you got to get it to be thermally reactive, where whenever it got to a certain temperature, an automatic vent would open up and it would take all the heat off your refrigerator and vent it outside or inside, depending on whatever temperature you wanted it to be inside. And so we got the solutions. There are all kinds of ways that we can make ourselves so incredibly efficient, and there wouldn't be no such thing as waste energy. And as far as it goes with the way that we're actually, using like compressors, when you compress air, it gets hot. When you release it rapidly, it has the opposite effect. It gets really cool. That's how that air conditioner works that you've got. It's, temperature differences and stuff. Pressure and releasing that pressure rapidly. Once you get that understanding of how this energy's working, how all these different devices are working, their weaknesses, their strengths, then you can actually start engineering machinery to take in consideration what's going on in that particular device, so that you can reduce the wasted energy. The internal combustion engine is probably, if there was ever a case for over-unity, the internal combustion engine would be the one. You put your gasoline in there, or your diesel in there, you run this engine, these average engines run anywhere from 160, 180 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit. Anything over that will begin to destroy that motor. The only place where you need that heat is inside the cylinder, where you have the reaction going between the the fuel and the air, and so that you can get the power to move that piston up and down. Well, the way that these engines are designed, a lot of that heat is transferred through the actual block itself. And so you've got a lot of wasted energy in the internal combustion engine. Those things will get so doggone hot, and if it weren't for the secondary systems like the radiator and the cooling system, they would literally fail. They would reach their thermal breakdown and they would fail. But if it was re-engineered properly, the only place you need that energy is inside the cylinder to cause those pistons to go up and down. You could reduce friction, you could reduce the amount of carbon blow-by in it by getting a proper burn every single time. The amount of fuel that you use would be lessened, because you would understand that you don't need near the amount of fuel. The faster you go, the less amount of fuel you should be using. But instead, we're trying to cram more power to those engines. Those engines have the capability of generating enough heat to literally destroy themselves. That's a lot of energy. A lot of wasted energy. Look at the exhaust pipe. Look at the doggone catalytic converter at the underneath it on the exhaust. And you'll see some things. You drive that car around for a long time and that catalytic converter can get so hot. That's why they tell you not to park it on the grass, especially if you got a car sitting really low to the ground, because you could set fire to that grass. They are therefore burning up the neighborhood and your car. That's safety issues. Safety first, folks. Just understand what's going on. A little bit of research into stuff would go a long ways as far as being able to be more efficient, be more safe, and all that kind of stuff. I hope to show, whenever I get my lab done, I hope to show you some things that make so much sense that the industry probably already knew to begin with. There's a word out there called planned obsolescence, or a phrase, planned obsolescence, where basically things have to fail in order so they can sell you new. But if they really cared about the environment, if they really cared about efficiency, if they really cared about reducing the amount of carbon emissions or fuel that's needed, then they would be listening to common sense. They would be doing these kind of things on a regular basis. But not too many not too many industries out there want to give up their piggy bank, so to speak, when it comes down to gasoline or diesel or any of the other, what they like to call fossil fuels. They're not going to want to tell you that there's a different and a better, more efficient way to use this fuel. And even if you didn't want to use that particular type of fuel, that there are other alternatives such as hydrogen technology. And you know, who wants you to know you can run your car with water if you understood how to do it? Now, keep in mind, the engines that are designed today aren't designed specifically to use water as fuel. But the technology is there, the science is there to specifically engineer an engine that will use water as fuel. If you understand the breakdown of water, if you understand the it's hydrogen, it's oxygen, you know, it takes three things to start a fire. It takes an ignition source, it takes an oxygen source, and it takes a fuel source, all of which is right there in that one amazing molecule. And so if you know by speeding that water up and slowing it down or whatever, you can get those molecules to get so incredibly hot that they will actually change from a liquid state to a gaseous state, and at that point could even be broken down even further. And so the jive turkeys out there telling you, well, look, Trollis, this is how we separate the hydrogen and oxygen and it takes too much power, they don't know what they're talking about. Stan Myers wasn't using electrolysis. He was using basically the equivalent of radio waves, all of which has been proven throughout time. There's even, you know, other people out there who had similar discoveries where they were talking about burning water, salt water, whatever, you know. But your microwave oven technology, it's a tiny little example of what I've been trying to say for a long time when it comes to hydrogen technology. And there's always safety concerns about hydrogen, but if you understand what hydrogen actually is, you understand the safety precautions, you can engineer these to only produce hydrogen as needed, on demand hydrogen. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility. It don't take that much water. It don't take as near as much as you think it does to create the amount of power that gasoline does. When you explode gasoline into a cylinder, it depends on the exhaust timing, the intake, the time that the compression occurs and all that. It takes a certain amount of time. Well, if you don't have enough time for a complete reaction, such as once that fuel is ignited, that it's all this fuel burns, then by the time that piston is coming back up and getting ready to open the exhaust port and send out the exhaust out the deal, you've got unburnt fuel still in that cylinder. And so with that said, you're not getting a complete burn. And whenever they want to run race cars, they feel like it's necessary that in order to get a better, stronger burn, that they got to put more air into that deal. You know, superchargers or doggone turbos or whatever. And so they're cramming more air in there, cramming more fuel in there. The faster that piston goes up, the less time it has for that fuel to actually completely burn. And so by the time they're not only generating more heat, but they're wasting more fuel down the pipe. Sure, they get some cars to go pretty doggone fast, you know. But the truth of the matter is, you wasted more energy and imagine the amount of heat, you know. We've got engines that are made out of aluminum now. You know, and aluminum has a shorter melting temperature than a lot of the other ones out there. So, you know, the simple expansion and contraction of something that gets hot and gets cold can cause those things to fail faster if they're not properly cooled. And so there's a whole lot to factor in. There's a lot of incredible science going on into the engineering of engines and stuff. But there's a lot of room for improvement. There's a lot of room for understanding the way that we deliver the fuel, the way that we deliver our electricity, the way that we use that electricity or the fuel, whichever way. There are so many different options available in order to improve the efficiency of it that if you actually took this into consideration and put it to practice, you wouldn't have any wasted energy. Wouldn't be no such thing as wasted energy, because it would all be utilized for its specific purpose in the proper fashion. It's in my mind, it's so ridiculously simple. But how do you get the world to pay attention? It's not that we don't have enough power, it's that we're just not using it right. And I hope to show what I've been trying to say all along. And when people see what it is that I'm saying, they can test it. They'll have everything they need to test it. They'll have all the information available to test it. They'll have all the information available to replicate it. And the moment they have all access to all this, then from that point on, it's up to them whether or not they take that idea and expand on it and run and take it to the extreme. Someday in history, we're actually going to see, you know, the equivalence of free electricity. But it ain't going to be free to us, because the system's always going to be in charge of it. That's why I say that right now's the time. Now's the time for us to get together and start building things. You know, put down the egos and pick up the tools and let's get it done. That's the simple of it. You can't expect that the system's going to have a sudden change of heart and say, you know, hey, we're tired of doing the people wrong, and so we're going to give them free electricity. It's just not going to happen. There's people in this world that need the luxury of electricity for they can have fresh water and heating and cooling and, you know, things like that. And yet, the way that the system's set up, not everybody gets to enjoy the luxury of what we call electricity, even though nature has provided it so abundant. More electricity than we can use in a trillion, 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 quadrillion, or whatever the highest number you can possibly fathom. more than you can even imagine. We've got every single resource necessary to resolve every single problem under the sun, with the exception of one problem that seems to be the conundrum, the riddle within a riddle or whatever. It's trying to figure out how to bring people together to do what needs to be done in order to uplift all of our brothers and sisters around this world. It ain't that we don't have the knowledge. We've got the vast sum of all man's knowledge at our fingertips. What are we doing with it? We're allowing little tiny fractions of our entire population to make rules and regulations that hinder and allow other people to get by with things that they shouldn't be getting by with. When it comes to safety, you have to be your first line of defense on that. You have to know about electricity if you're going to mess around with electricity. But also, at the same sense, don't want you to fear it either. Because it's amazing. It's something that nature has provided. You know, it ain't no different than knowing better to run out into a lightning storm holding an umbrella or a metal pole. You know, you wouldn't do that. It's not common sense. Stay out of a lightning storm. That's a lot of power. We have the capability of harnessing lightning. We have the capability of storing lightning in a can. So, you know, we ain't never going to run out of power. You know, people go through what they call brownouts and blackouts all the time because of the equipment failure. But if it was done properly, equipment would never fail. You know, there's so many different ways in order to make built-in systems with backups and redundancy that it couldn't fail, no matter what happened. We could move into the future. We could literally boldly go where no man has gone before if we wanted to. We just got to make that choice. So, you know, I do what I do here on Mad Science, and you know, I try to share all this information with you. I try to put it in the simplest fashion. You know, there's a whole lot more to safety when it comes to electricity. You got to take the time to go peek at it. You know, you don't want batteries blowing up in your pocket. it's terrible. If you see some of these videos and some of the injuries that people have gotten from modifying systems like those vaping deals, and they got this thing in their pocket, and for some reason it shorts out and the battery ignites, you know, gets a thermal breakdown, and runs away from itself, gets a runaway reaction, and then the next thing you know, it explodes. You know, and when it comes to, you know, just the common household electricity and people not paying attention to safety issues such as the thickness of that wire, you know, you need to read that safety label on there. If it says it's only good for small appliances under so many watts, then you don't take 20 of said appliances and stick it in the same wire. It's not going to work like that. You got this power coming down the deal, and it's bouncing back and forth between the device and the thing, and that wire in between ain't designed to handle that amount of current. Because regardless of what you think, when you turn your electric fan on, it's not just the wall outlet that's producing power. Your electric fan is kicking power back as well. When that field expands and then it collapses, it's producing energy in there. It's got a magnetic field of its own, and it's sending what they call back EMF back down that wire. So these two power sources are colliding with each other. And it's like blowing up a balloon. You got this balloon. You can only put so much pressure in there before something's got to give. So the amount of current coming in, the amount of it trying to make it back the other direction, fighting with each other, produces resistance, which in turn produces heat, and eventually a thermal breakdown occurs of either the insulation on the copper windings in your fan or the insulation on the wiring for your house, and then something, you know, has to fail. But once you understand all that, once you understand how powerful that those fan motors are, and how less amount of power that they actually need to run, there's a way to capture that energy on the way out of that fan. You sent it in, you energized the primary on that, the field expanded, it interacted with the next field in line, it turned the fan, and then when that field collapses, some of that power shoots back in the opposite direction. Well, when it comes down to building the motor generator, there's a generator out there called the Red Line that they use, electrical companies use it. I got two of these things, and they're really expensive, but they're 12 volts to 120 volts at 500 watts apiece. They're an electric motor that runs off a 12-volt battery that has a generator built into it. Even that particular device could be improved upon to where the motor and the generator are one and the same. It's been done before. They have old motor generators from way back when. They used to have them on tractors. Some still do have these motor generators. It's used as the starter to start the tractor, and then when the tractor gets up to operating speed, then that motor becomes the generator that keeps the battery charged. So we have the technology to build generators that are actually electric motors. The motor itself becomes the generator once it starts running. So you don't have a secondary, like on a regular gasoline engine generator. You got the gasoline engine, which is the prime mover of the generator head, and it turns its spinning magnets, which produces your AC current coming out the deal. But in an electric generator, it would be electric motor running that generator head. Imagine that electric motor, instead of running a secondary device such as a generator head, that electric motor itself was the generator. It was built in. But it was built in with the knowledge of how the which direction the electrical current is going in the generator as it's in its motor capacity. And then whenever it comes around to the time whenever you want to use it as, you know, the generator portion of it, you have that electrical current going in the same direction so that nothing is fighting against each other. And then you're pulling power off in a different fashion than you did normally in order to reduce the back EMF that would be coming off of that generator after you connected it to a load. So you could run this generator as a motor. The motor's running and it's producing electricity at the same exact time while it's running, and it's working in perfect synchronicity so that all this energy is traveling in the exact same way. So all you're using that motor generator for at that time is pushing that energy through and sending it all in the same direction. None of it's fighting each other. None of it's fighting itself in order to produce the electricity that you want to use. You know, and when it comes down to getting out more than you're putting in, you don't need to get out more than you put in. If you could get close enough to efficiency to where you're getting out the same exact amount that you're putting in on the opposite side, that's more than good enough. You know, even if you're only getting a fraction of what you're getting out the other side. If you understand how to use that energy properly, you can ramp it up, you can slow it down, you can build transformers, custom transformers, that'll step it up, step it down, move that energy the way you want it to. Now, as far as coming around making it self-looping and stuff like that, that's not even necessary. I mean, if you got a large enough battery bank, you can use secondary systems to keep that thing charged up. See, everybody's looking for the magic. They're looking for the magic pill. They're looking for the holy grail. They're looking for, you know, the something for nothing kind of thing. When in reality, you don't even need to go that far. You make it incredibly efficient. That means the person don't have to spend so much doggone money on electricity every month. When that energy comes out that wall, you paid for it. It's yours now. But there are power companies out there that don't want you to understand that. Years ago, there was a story about a man who built a generator that ran off of a 110-volt outlet. And what he did with that was he ramped that voltage up, and he was running the rest of his entire house off of one outlet. That's because he understood how that energy traveled. But then they tried to get him for stealing electricity, because how could you run your house off of this amount of voltage when you got all these different appliances? Because he understood how the energy traveled. There's a guy out there named Gerard Morin who he's pretty frustrated with life, so he's got a pretty foul mouth on him. But nonetheless, his science makes sense whenever you get down to the brass tacks of it all. How energy's traveling. He took a 1500 or 2500 watt generator and ran that power, instead of running your appliances directly off of it, run it into a 15 kV transformer down, or 25 or 50 kV transformer down into a 25 kV transformer, and then ran the load off of that smaller transformer, and was able to run more than that generator was capable of running. That's because he understood how that energy was traveling. And I was listening in that video for that doggone generator to bog down. It did not bog down. When he connected all, he had three 1500 watt generators and a reciprocating saw connected to it. It didn't bog that generator down. And so, how is that done? It's by understanding how that energy actually travels. He gave that energy a place to go. It wasn't making a direct path right back into the same generator that he's trying to pull the power from. And therefore, with the 50 kV transformer being charged up, once the 25 is charged up, all he had to do is keep a constant flow of energy to the 50, as long as it never went completely dry. Then the doggone 25 would be completely full, and that's what he run the load off of. I don't understand why people haven't figured this out. The power companies understood how to figure it out. Think about how many transformers that a power company runs. Think about the way that they ground it to the earth. Why would they do that? Think about the way that they actually send that power out, at what frequency range they're actually sending it out. You couldn't use that electricity in your house. They know that. But when it all comes down to it, all these secrets, the secrets are in the details. If you paid attention in science class and you're paying attention to mad science, then there should be light bulbs coming on right now in your mind. And if you get your house to be so incredibly efficient where you can reduce the amount of money that you have to pay the electric company every single month, you're not stealing electricity. You're paying for whatever comes out that wall. And so whatever you do with it from that point on, you know, there are people out there who do things like pass things in building codes and even, you know, housing complexes where you get in these doggone deals where you're, you know, with the homeowners association and stuff like that. They pass regulations that try to discourage people from doing things like what I'm talking about, you know, as far as making yourself, you're turning your house into a power plant, you know. So if you got wind turbines or windmills out there in your yard and you got all these solar panels, they'll complain about it because it don't look pretty or doesn't match what everybody else has got and all that kind of stuff. That's why my advice to you is never move into any place that has a homeowners association. If you go to a neighborhood and every house looks identical, don't buy a house there because you ain't going to get nowhere that way. You go out there someplace that's not zoned and so you don't have all the regulations that everybody else has, and you put your doggone solar panels up and you save yourself as much money, and that money that you save then you can reinvest into people that you believe in, you know, yourself, your family. If you find an alternative energy researcher that's working on a project and you want to see it through and help them get it done and help each other out. Build you a mad science club in every single community out there. Build you a mad science club and bring those brilliant minds together using your talents. So, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to inspire people to go into your communities, find the best of the best that you got in there. Bring each other together, share your resources, and help each other to become incredibly energy efficient so that you're not having to pay the man. Every time you have to pay the man, well, that's less you got to reinvest into you. You think about it. You think about what I'm saying. You think about even to the extent of going out renting property. You pay a lot of money just to rent a house. And you'll never get to own that house. You gotta keep on paying the man. And on top of that, you gotta pay the electric bill. You gotta pay the water bill, the gas bill, fuel costs for your vehicles. That's one of the reasons why they don't want free energy out there. Because it takes away their power. Literally. I'm gonna keep on doing what it is I do. I'm gonna keep on sharing all these things. You know, today I threw in a little bit about safety. There's a lot more to safety than meets the eye. Go out there and check it out. If you're concerned about the environment, then there are things that can be done, such as, you know, your batteries, even the non-rechargeables. They got systems out there that will recharge non-rechargeable batteries. I haven't got to check into one of these, but there's one called ReZap. Look into that one. If anybody's ever tested it and can verify that it does what it says it does, then, you know, we'll talk about it again. But there's so much out there available. You wouldn't be throwing these batteries away anymore. You'd be recharging them and reusing them multiple times. And then if you ever did have to, because it's completely bad, then you could dispose of it knowing that, you know, first, you got the most amount of use out of it as possible. And second, when you do dispose of it, you'll know what materials are involved in that that can be either reclaimed or resalvaged and be able to done in a environmentally friendly fashion. A lot of people talk about saving the environment, but very few people really go to the extremes of making it so. You know, there's... you know, standing out there with a wooden stick and a paper sign saying save the trees. But there are people who do. And there are people out there that don't want you to know a lot of things that we talk about. When it comes down to the future of energy, how we use it, we've become accustomed to have nice lighting systems and heating systems and the luxury of just being able to walk over and flip the switch on. But wouldn't it be nice if each of our homes was the storage bank? Some of the materials that we use in our houses. You know, you got aluminum siding out there. Imagine a system to where your house, your actual house, was a storage bank for energy. So, you'd be charging up your siding using the energy from the thermal on your roof. And using that power, allowing that nature's power to go, you know, naturally through the system. And without causing it to destroy anything. Imagine that. Your house is the battery. Yeah, everything that nature has provided is used. That's the capability we've got. When it comes down to smaller systems, running larger systems, I'm going to show that. Once I get my lab done, I'm going to show some pretty cool stuff. Put it all into practice. Show you how I got it, where I got it, off the shelf, the model type, how it's actually wired up, what it's actually doing, explanation and all, that you can see how this is actually functioning. We've got some amazing circuits right now. And some of these circuits like the 30-amp RC motor controller circuits, you know, they're incredible. If those things were kept cool and could never reach their thermal breakdown point, they would never fail. If you understood how that energy is actually going into that motor, there are methods by which you could ensure that all that excess energy has a place to go, and it's not feeding back into the circuit, causing it to get hot to begin with. So safety for your devices, safety for you, safety for the environment. You don't have to go out and dig up more resources if you got resources that'll last a long time. You know, the whole fossil fuel industry, it's a lie. And that's something they don't want people to know, that it's a lie. You ain't going to run out of it. It's not possible. But there are those who will argue till they're blue in the face that I don't know what I'm talking about. I told somebody, I said, what would you say if I said there is no such thing as fossil fuel? And they said, well, I'd tell you you were crazy. That's because the school told them that it was. The science community said it was. We've been told a lie so long that we believe it, and we actually repeat that misinformation to everyone and his brother. And because a whole lot of people believe it, the majority of people believe it, and if you believe anything different, you're the odd duck. You're the guy out. And so they're going to say, well, you know, all these scientists say, well, yeah, I'm sure all those scientists do say, but not all scientists say. A real scientist is not going to close his mind to possibilities. That's a fact. You know, you test the laws of physics, you test the mechanical knowledge and engineering and all this kind of stuff. There's always a way to improve on what man has created. But there ain't no way to improve on what nature's already done. It's plain and simple. Tamar's in the chat room said, add steam engines to get rid of excess heat. Yeah. You're running that internal combustion engine anyway. So why not use that heat to boil water to produce steam pressure to literally, you know, assist that vehicle down the road? So that's a brilliant one there. We got solutions how to do this. But we just got to get around to it. We just got to finally decide that, you know, enough's enough with the system that we're in, and just do something. As we the people, just get it done. It's as simple as that. Well, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play us up out here with some tunes. You know, doing a 3-hour show takes a lot out of a person. So I'm going to throw in a couple tunes to burn up a little bit of time before the Music with Kara Hour, which is coming up next. Folks, you've been listening to Mad Science. I hope you got something out of the day. And I hope you share the podcast if you find the information worthy. But either way, I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing. Keep an eye on my YouTube channel. And once I get that lab, you're going to get the chance to see that. And the way that I start to show things, they're going to make a whole lot more sense than prior. So I'm doing the best I can with what I got to work with. Peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science Show. Take care.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Because when the old boys raise on shotguns, we say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. Came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Get off the set.
down. Never mind that. Never mind.
Why, that's me. Look at me. I'm an old man.
I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot.
Thank God I still got my hair. October 26th. What on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Wow, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, Doc.
No. This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
The flux capacitor stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott! What the hell is a gigawatt? How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts? Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Whoa, Doc, stuck here? I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
Oh, she's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what she wrote here, Doc. I mean... That says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, this might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
television studio.
Stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop. There it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.